This is Sabrina Monarch, and this is a show about spiritual lifestyle and personal evolution. I'm an evolutionary astrologer, a clairvoyant, and a thought leader, and I started this podcast to have eclectic and impactful conversations about astrology, as well as all things spiritual and personal development. Today was the first day teaching the new cohort of the Evolutionary Astrology Intensive. I'm really so excited about working with a new group of students to share this really life-changing language of evolutionary astrology. I've been teaching this course since late 2017, and it grows richer and deeper. Aries season really came through our first class, not just for the fact that we're beginning something and it is Aries season and all of that, and beginnings being Aries, of course, but that the student shares today really had a lot of themes around courage, which is an Aries thing in particular, the kind of courage that we need to back our soul direction in this life, even if it doesn't make mental sense or if it pushes us up against some of our deeper fears. In other vibe check news, I'm really loving Aries season. I'm having a fitness breakthrough. I'm getting stronger at the gym. I'm dancing. I'm getting ready for my move to Greece that will be coming up in Taurus season. And whenever I tell people I'm moving and they ask where and I say Greece, people are very surprised. It's interesting because I just felt the call and I'm answering it. It's taken a lot of work and planning, and although I'm very excited, I'm also scared, and I'm still doing it. And people's surprise about it has gotten me to realize that what I'm doing is kind of unusual. People will ask if it's for a job or if I'm married or what, and it's like, no, I'm just going because I want to. My heart is really opening every day from a combination of things. My life in Portland is feeling really beautiful, and I am for real shedding some tears about leaving and really also trusting this leap. I talked about some of this, like what's been going on in my life, a bit in a recent episode where I shared my personal experience with the Jupiter-Uranus transit that's currently building by the day and is exact April 20th. And you can find that just a few episodes back. So what I have for you today is a new interview. I actually have some more interviews on deck, which is exciting. This one is a conversation I had with Ta'alo Mote, an astrologer friend who recently created an online community for householders. This is a term that denotes people whose spiritual practice takes place in everyday life, as opposed to leaving the world of everyday life for like a monastery, for example. Something, you know, the householder path I actually really resonate with as a person whose spirituality is really connected to my everyday life in the way that all of my soul lessons that my natal chart points to happen in the material of my life, just like it does for you. You know, it's like my inner world, my body, my personal and professional relationships. My life is the material of my spiritual path. And yeah, I don't feel any urge to escape it for something different. Most of the time, you know, and that's where I find the deepest fulfillment and joy really is like when I feel connected to myself and this incarnation. I think it's really important to steward our lives, you know, steward what we've been given. Tal's community is currently growing and it sounds like an awesome and deeply supportive place. He and I discussed what householder spirituality is. We talked about the weaving of different spiritual lineages, his family, his rabbi wife's in-person community startup, and what he's learned from creating BASE, his online householder community. I feel a distinct warmth from Tal that goes beyond the fact he's a Leo sun, but I feel it also in the intention and care he puts into the details of life, relationship, and community. That kind of consciousness that draws from the numinous, the vastness, the spiritual, and really focuses it in the unique moment and what that moment creatively asks for. Ta'alo Mote, or Tal for short, is a writer, musician, astrologer, rabbi's husband, and father of two from Atlanta, Georgia. He is a lay initiate of Michael Elliston Roshi at the Atlanta Soto Zen Center. His wife, Rabbi Ariel Root Wolpe, is the founder of Ma'alot, a spiritual community transforming Jewish life in Atlanta through music, nature, and Jewish wisdom. Tal plays the drums there and helps run Netzach, or Commitment, the container for men's work in the Ma'alot community. Tal has a website, talamot.space, where he writes, podcasts, takes photos, and makes videos about spirituality and everyday life, and offers a 90-minute face-to-face fireside chat, as well as a variety of written astrology consultations. The site has an annual membership called Householders, where people balancing committed spiritual practices with busy worldly lives can hang out and hold counsel on topics of community, family, livelihood, skills, and spirituality. And I'll leave you to our conversation now. Hey everyone, I'm here with Tal Lumot to talk about the householder life, which is something that I've been getting more perspective on from you, really. And so you have written up a really beautiful write-up on your lineages from Judaism to Buddhism to astrology. I would love to hear kind of more about that as an introduction. And I'm also curious how you weave the three of those. I know, like, being an astrologer, we get to be really multifaceted and multidimensional. But yeah, it's always cool to hear how people combine astrology with other fields. So I'd love to hear how that's been for you.
Sure. Thank you, Sabrina, for having me. Thank you for the honor of getting to speak on the subject of my lineages. This is a very important thing to me, the concept of lineage and sort of how all of my work in spiritual fields is organized according to these lineages that I claim as explicit lineages, and these three in particular that you've named. And there's more, you know, everybody's got many lineages. This is a thing I find myself needing to talk about a lot, especially with people who don't feel like they have clear ancestral lineages or have ever had a teacher, even in a lineage that they do feel like they belong to, that they don't feel like they've properly received. I always start off a conversation about lineage by saying everything you've ever inherited from anywhere is a lineage. So with that said, there are these three lineages that I sort of claim explicit transmission in, and with specific teachers I can point to, and, you know, other sort of life circumstances that led me to identify with those practices. And those are the three areas that I feel like most qualified to share and to practice and to offer things from. So the Jewish lineage comes first because it's my, genetic ancestral lineage, and the one that my parents transmitted to me. And, you know, I was raised in a fairly typical, non-Orthodox American Jewish home, which is to say, culturally identifying as Jews was very important. I had all my grandparents growing up, and that was very important to them too. My family is from the late 1800s wave of European Jewish immigrants. So there were several generations of people in my family here already before I was born. No Yiddish speakers or anything like that, but everybody had, you know, their handful of Yiddish sayings or just words that were part of their way of speaking. We observed the major holidays and went to synagogue, you know, on those, but didn't really keep too strictly religious of a home. I was sent to religious school. So like I learned to read Hebrew. I learned like your fundamentals about the Bible and holidays and so forth. I was trained to have a bar mitzvah, although that was an interesting story that maybe we'll end up talking about. It was kind of hard for me to receive all of this Jewish stuff. I had a lot of questions and I didn't get a lot of answers, or I got a lot of unsatisfactory answers. But it got in there, you know? And so I actually didn't wander too far for too long before kind of coming back to Jewish practice and finding teachers and peers that really meant a lot to me, more than, you know, like the rabbi at the synagogue that I grew up at. But, you know, by college, I was already into that. But in my sort of teen years, like in high school, I did start to wander around. Actually, it was really when I was preparing for my bar mitzvah that I like declared that I was a atheist and or a pagan and or whatever. And I got my first like Wicca book then and learned my first divination tools then. And that is actually where I would start sort of the tree of the astrology lineage. I do call it an astrology lineage, but there really was sort of more divination. There were more divination techniques and more sort of ways of reading signs from reality than just astrology. But the, you know, the moon and sun and the cycles of the year, you know, that's all Jewish ritual time keeping too. So that was all in there from the beginning. So I started exploring. I found Wicca, I found tarot, I found the beginnings of astrology then. And I also, that is when I encountered Buddhism and read my first sort of pop Buddhism book, you know, New York Times bestseller list kind of thing. But that reading led me to the ability to have conversations with like the first actual Buddhists I would encounter in my life. And it was in college where I found my first Zen teacher. It was actually part of my academic study there. But I was also super involved in Jewish life on campus. And so those two things always sort of worked in parallel for me, but they were offering me different things. And, you know, there's a lot we could talk about and a lot and unpack about that statement. But just to sort of finish the lineage story, like that was all going on. And then I fell in love with an astrologer, my junior year of college. And she was actually the one who initiated me first into, you know, the idea of your birth chart is more than just your sun sign. You know, here's what all of your placements mean. Here's what the houses mean, that sort of thing. I mean, I actually still have I think it was for my 20th or 21st birthday, she made me some sort of write up of my whole chart that's like bound with yarn and printed on printer paper. And I still have that somewhere. So by the time I graduated college, all three of these things were happening. And then, you know, there a lot of other, you know, winding stories could be told here, but really these three things were like braided together pretty well for me by the time I was like 21, 22 years old. And then I met the one more thing that feels important to say about the lineage is then I met the person who would become my wife, and she went to rabbinical school shortly after we met, and I went with her, and then she got ordained, and now she is a rabbi. So on top of all of these things, I am a rabbi's husband, and that is sort of my householder duty. And Jewish life is sort of the centerpiece of what we do as a family, professionally and socially and, you know, culturally, religiously, everything. But I still maintain both my Zen lineage in a more formal way. And, you know, then there's the astrology stuff, which I'm sure we'll get to as well. But it all braids together is really the answer to the question that was in there.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think as astrologers, there's like a multiplicity and whatnot. Like sometimes when it comes to like worldviews, belief systems, traditions, a lot of the people that I know are involved in multiple, as opposed to picking just one. And I'm curious, like, if you have any thoughts or examples around parts of each of those lineages that really make sense together in your practice.
Well, the astrology part is the hardest part to draw into the center, because there are a lot of, let's call them, strains of Jewish culture and religion that make it seem like this isn't something that we do as a people, as a culture, etc. Not just astrology in particular, but even like the very idea of predictive divination is like against the rules for some people. But I don't, yeah, I think a lot of people in maybe more like broader astrology culture with Christian backgrounds, for example, feel like that's a pretty cut and dry thing for like, you know, Abrahamic religion, that like astrology is not allowed, divination is not allowed. It's really a lot more nuanced and complicated than that, at least in terms of Jewish culture. And, you know, there are synagogues from the Hellenistic period with zodiacs on the ceiling all over the Middle East and, you know, Mediterranean. And there are texts in Hebrew that have the planets, and you know, it's all in there. It's just it's more, the prohibitions are more about certain ways of using powerful stuff in certain cultural situations. It's much more specific than all of that. But the thing that actually I was going for is a later development, you know, in the sort of Islamicate world of you know, medieval astrology, that really feels like sort of the most dominant strain of traditional astrology out there right now. Like, people are starting to realize that, you know, that these largely Muslim astrologers were really hitting it pretty hard. They were like developing some of the greatest techniques and, you know, making the most accurate predictions and all that sort of thing. And I think maybe something that a lot of Jewish people into astrology these days might be glad to know is that there were a lot of Jewish people mixed in there in those societies, the most famous of whom would definitely be Rabbi Ibn Ezra, who was an author of astrological texts in Hebrew. And we have them, you know, like we have manuals to, you know, horary and electional astrology and nativities from this rabbi who is, and it's not just like, you know, this is something else that people don't realize, especially non-Jewish astrologers who have studied Ibn Ezra because he's a great astrologer. They don't realize that this isn't just some weird occult figure. Ibn Ezra is a Torah, like the foremost Torah commentator. He's like one of the couple of commentaries on the Torah that like every Orthodox Jewish student reads and learns. Like he's a mainstream figure, and he was an astrologer, you know? So a lot of, and there are other strains of Jewish mysticism and other like sort of later practices, Kabbalah, etc., where astrology is part of it. Hasidut, like Hasidic sects that use astrology, or at least have, you know, one weird teacher who said astrology was cool and nobody knew what to make of him, and that's, you know, all you get. But this is what I try to do in terms of integrating these lineages, because, you know, I'm in a pretty central position in a Jewish community, with a lot of people who haven't really encountered astrology, at least in a way that feels Jewish or Jewish enough, whatever that means to them. But there's a lot of people curious about astrology these days, as you know, you well know, I'm sure. And so it comes up all the time. And so I feel like I have to be ready to answer those kinds of questions with like Jewish sources and teachings. And there are plenty of them, fortunately.
Well, that's incredible. Sometimes I find myself hanging out with astrology, like, hey, if you're interested, good. But like, conveying astrology to people that may have like worldview based resistances or like haven't encountered it before is almost like my least, the demographic I connect about astrology with the least. Yeah. Like, yeah. So I actually, there's a lot that goes into those kind of conversations. And maybe the closest I came was like sitting on a plane next to a woman who was Christian and she was reading a book about business. And I was like, chatting with her. I was very almost like friendlier at that time in my life. I'd always just chat with people and was connecting with her about business. And then we were talking about that for like 20, 30 minutes. And she asked me what I did. And I said, I was an astrologer, and she jumped, like she was kind of spooked. And she like said that she was Christian. And like, we just kind of had this conversation about it where at the end she was like, maybe God put the planets there for a reason. And
go. So
there was like already a way to kind of, you know, rationalize or understand. And so I think it's really interesting when we dip between different worldviews or like work with multiple, that there's ways that each worldview can kind of hold or explain or encompass the other or not, you know, and we have to figure that out ourselves, essentially.
I think of it as sort of like parallax vision, right? Like the reason we have two eyes. And this feels like kind of a nice, like a Hellenistic astrology sort of philosophical way of looking at it too. Like you can see something in more depth if you have multiple perspectives on it. It's like what conversation is for. And so as long as the other person is listening, it's actually really fruitful to have conversations from different points of view this way. And this is a huge value of mine. The problem is like people are not always listening. And so there are other skills, other householder skills involved in sort of making that connection with someone. And as long as you're connected, you know, you can be who you are, and the person can witness you and, you know, hopefully realize you're not, you know, doing the devil's work or something.
Right. So to bring it to householders, what is that term originally and how are you using it now?
That is a term that I pull from my Buddhist lineage, which I feel good about at this point in our conversation, because like there is this other huge part of my spiritual life that hasn't factored into the answers yet. But I do have Buddhist training, and I learned the word householder from that, although the original sense of the word comes from early Buddhism and means something very different in the Zen tradition that I'm in by that point, which is thousands of years later. But in the early Buddhist tradition, the word householder, always the word householder is sort of refers to is like the opposite of a monk. Like it's that you're one or the other. You're a householder if you live in the world and you, you know, have families and jobs and material concerns. And if you're a home leaver, which is another term for what the, you know, that shows you how opposed the terms were, you leave home and you become a monk. That's sort of like the classic early Buddhist story of like renouncing the, you know, material world and going off to pursue enlightenment. And in some of these texts, some of these early Buddhist texts, the word householder is even used in like a pejorative sense to by students of the Buddha who like look down their noses at these simple householders, you know, like who have to worry about such mundane things. But as Buddhism moves around the world through different societies that have different values and different economics, etc., that it takes on a very different sense, because obviously the world does not go on without householders. Like families and the transmission of culture and all of the things that householders are responsible for is like how human beings survive. And of course there's like a deep spiritual importance to that work. And so over time, the term householder becomes, at least equal, you know, it becomes a veneration, a term of veneration for, usually within the tradition for someone who's like financially supporting the Sangha, meaning contributing money or materials or whatever to the upkeep of the Buddhist facility where, you know, those people are saying mantras for, you know, the householders, and it's an exchange of some kind. But eventually it makes its way.
I want to pause at that part, because that's really interesting. Like the idea that some people are maintaining society, mm-hmm. and then the house leavers, mm-hmm. are doing something spiritual that's benefiting the community. So there's like a symbiotic connection there, but totally very different paths.
Yeah. And that's something, that's the kind of thing that I feel like a lot of, you know, so-called Western Buddhists, like people who think that Buddhism is a set of philosophical principles and like actions, mechanical actions you can do that can just, you can just sort of copy into your own culture without any of the cultural or lineage transmission that goes along with it. They tend to miss that part, that like there is actually a reciprocal value to all of this in like a society where the Buddhist cosmos is something that everybody, you know.
Right. And like what is happening, like I feel like I read a poem at some point, maybe it was like Young Pueblo or something, but they was talking about like a person who was meditating and they were alone meditating, but the whole community was benefiting from it. Like there was a field that the meditator was creating that was creating peace in the community. And it was, you know, I think that concept is not so in the West in the sense of like the mechanical worldview where it's like, how could a person meditating alone affect the whole community? But yes. I'm wondering if that's part of what you were speaking to with like the person who's doing the mantras and.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm speaking to. And the thing is, it's also super resonant with Jewish values too. That, and this is something that has been lost in the sort of assimilation of Jews into the quote unquote Western world, then, and the, you know, adoption of sort of more rationalistic and materialistic outlooks and values that came with that. In the Orthodox world, you know, people study Torah for hours and hours a day and the whole community supports them. And it's for the same reason. It's like there is, you know, the relative value of, if we have to draw a clean division, like spiritual work versus material work or whatever, may be different in different communities or what have you. But the idea that doing spiritual work as real work that is valued by the household or community is a deep Jewish value, and definitely also a deep Buddhist value. And so this is one really key way in which my lineages harmonize for me as a householder, but also, you know, as the husband of a rabbi. But that's another great, you know, way in which Jews have blended these two paths, that like the rabbi is the sort of spiritual exemplar of the community, and that's a person who has a family and ideally many children, and, you know, like lives in a big house and has people over all the time, and the rabbi's spouse is constantly cooking and washing dishes and etc. Like that is what the example of Jewish spirituality looks like. It's both.
And so your definition of householder, like how you see it now, how would you define it?
Well, I would say that the way that I define it now is pretty, you know, closely aligned with the way that my Zen Sangha defines it. And Zen, you know, is, like I said, it's centuries later. And, you know, first in China, then in Japan, it's like a completely different society than the one where the word householder was coined as a pejorative. And it's one that works much more like what we're talking about, where like people from the village come to hear the Dharma talks. And, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship, like you said. And my Sangha, actually, our teacher explicitly describes it as a householder Sangha. Almost everybody in the Sangha is like someone who lives in a house, maybe with a family, certainly with a job, you know, does other things, and Zen practice is something that they do as a sort of restorative, and to varying extents, religious practice that supports them in their householder life. And so, that is the kind of Zen that I practice. And it's, you know, I'll take a retreat whenever I can get one, but I can't get them super often anymore with two little kids and, you know, supporting a wife who's starting a religious community from scratch. I mean, she's basically a startup founder. Like, don't think of a rabbi's schedule, think of like a startup founder schedule. So, you know, there's a lot of little gaps in the world for practice, and that's where I find it. And that's what householder practice is to me, is finding ways to sustain that eternal flame, that spiritual fire in the everyday life, because it's the only opportunities that householders have. But those opportunities are really beautiful, and usually in the midst of very profound things. You know, family is a very profound form of practice, and career is a very profound form of practice. There's, you know, difficult relationships and finding common ground and hurting and healing going on all around. It's like a faster paced version of the practice than I've had on retreat. And, you know, I've done a fair amount of retreat practice too. And like that can go really deep in ways that I don't get a chance to do very often these days. But, you know, there are different dimensions of depth in spiritual practice. And the one of being surrounded by other people and having to make a life together gets as deep as it goes. It's just a different form.
Agreed. You know, like in an earlier conversation we had, we were talking about Virgo Pisces and like this connection between like how that axis holds the spiritual in Pisces and the quote mundane in Virgo, but that actually you can't separate them, like that we kind of do that mentally where we think that parts of our lives are not spiritual and other parts are. But if you see everything, even the quote mundane details as spiritual, they become spaces for us to practice. Like our mat, so to speak, is on, you know, in the family environment, it's in our relationships, it's at work, like it's everywhere. And so bringing that kind of consciousness or sincerity to all those parts of life is a spiritual orientation that I really relate to, honestly, too. And yeah, putting it in the householder context is newer for me to think about.
Mm-hmm. I think it's something that people are really reaching for these days. And I happen to just be one of the people who put a one word description on it that is turning on light bulbs for some people. But I don't think I'm introducing anyone to any kind of new realization about the importance of everyday life. It's just that, like, it's supportive to know that there is a rich tradition of seeing everyday life as spiritual practice. And there are many rich traditions of it. And people, you know, coming out of the pandemic, like high pandemic period, isolation period, that there was a big reset all around me and within me in terms of how important intentional community would be. And there's all kinds of different experiments with that going on. But like that was the online environment into which I started really posting about this and finding that people were really seeking it and maybe have always been seeking it and just needed a little bit of like a crystallization of what its values actually are. You know, I think that a lot of what the pandemic period laid bare for people was that people don't, that we don't really live in a society, you know, we live I'm talking about like in the United States, for example, in the, you know, the first quote unquote first world, where people were just like reduced to such inhuman behavior and like lack of care and compassion, and also just like the collapse of society, like the fact that we just did not have the ability to like hold what was happening to us as a civilization. It just sort of wrecked us. And I think that it reset a lot of people in terms of what they want their society to look like. And that's an opportunity to remember that like the work of healing the incarnate material world is like of utmost importance and requires that strength of spiritual practice to do. It's not something we're going to like fix. Optimize. We have to really bring our heart into it.
I mean, this is where it's all happening. I feel like, I think that working with evolutionary astrology has really prepared me for like a down and in spirituality, where it's like not about ascension. There are ways where it's like you can totally travel or have like high experiences or peak experiences or beyond experiences, but rooting them into everyday or to the personal underworld, the deep psyche, relationship conflicts, personal crises, like all of that is where the material happens and gets integrated. So it's all really relevant. And I think avoiding our lives in pursuit of spirituality can cause some imbalances for people. I think it's different if someone really is like on that house leaver path, but just like out in the wild house leaving, I don't know how much it actually, you know, like there's stuff that's happening for people personally. There's crises, conflicts, relational things that come up, and all of them have a lot of room for like our karmic and dharmic material to present itself. So it's important in that way. And I'm curious if you had a time in your spiritual seeking where you felt like you wanted to leave things behind, and what that was like for you to find this orientation that you have now.
Yeah, I mean, the first time was definitely that 12 or 13 year old period that I mentioned, where I didn't want to have a bar mitzvah because it was boring. And so, you know, I went off seeking the occult by myself and, you know, ended up finding surprising things there that weren't what I, you know, they weren't for, well, what happened first was I did start to practice on my own. I started to figure out what it meant in the very basic sense to do any spiritual practice alone, without anyone watching, without any social consciousness of what, well, without any human beings watching, right? Like without feeling watched. And then, you know, so I would, you know, draw my circle in the park across the street from my house. And I would, you know, I would pick up a stick and I would like write, you know, sigils in the dirt, and then I would swing the stick around in circles and point it at the sky or do whatever it was I did. And then what I found was that I wasn't alone. You know, that was sort of the thing that surprised me, because I had never actually had that feeling in synagogue before. You know, I was much too concerned with the social consciousness of like this, you know, these disapproving adults all around me to like really concentrate on that, you know, that called the mama daka, to use the Hebrew, the still small voice that God appears to us with. And, you know, this experience taught me how to do that. You know, like I had that experience in synagogue all the time now. It's just like, I had never really gone off by myself like that before. And that was very important for me to do. And it helped me with some things I didn't know were problems for me, like just sort of overstimulation and sort of social exhaustion, like needing a lot of space alone with my thoughts. And that's what led me to Buddhism. That was what appealed to me romantically, aesthetically about Buddhism, was the idea of like going off and sitting cross-legged on top of a mountain. And what I found instead was that, and this isn't the only period, this is just the first time, you know, when I was a teenager that I thought that was what I wanted, was to leave home in all of those senses. What I found instead was that sitting in meditation provided me the ability to leave home in that sense without leaving home, that there was like a protected space I could create for myself to be, you know, alone with my creator in my bedroom, you know, for 10 minutes and then, you know, go back out. And so that was a big insight, but it wasn't the last time that I sort of had that revolutionary fervor of the home leaver, of like, this society sucks, like it's irredeemable, like get me out of here. And that happened again in a big way in sort of my mid-20s, early to mid-20s, which was a pretty rock and roll period. It was a literal rock and roll period. There was a lot of music being played and recorded and performed. There was Burning Man, was sort of like a central activity for me and my whole, that's what the whole group of people that I knew was sort of how we all met. And so it was like a kind of a year round ritual cycle of going to Burning Man, cleaning up and getting ready to go again. And, you know, out there in particular, I really, I got tired of all the noisy people at Burning Man and would wander off into the middle of nowhere there too, and just sort of seek like the,
that's really funny, honestly. Yeah. I feel like Burning Man is like one of those things that like festival culture is a peak experience outside of normal life. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the fractal of like going to that, but being like, wait, but I have to go beyond.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was like, I went out there to go beyond, and then like everybody was just sort of drinking in camp and listening to like hair metal. And so, you know, I decided to go farther out than that, and farther out literally and further out sort of spiritually. And I did, you know, I did all of the things that one does in festival culture, and all of the like self-annihilating experiences that anyone needs to have. And they were very important to me. But again, and this is a common thing, a lot of my like a lot of people who are even still like all the way on the train in terms of psychedelic practice in my life still talk like this. They say like, there's nothing like coming home after going out into the great beyond. And that is the experience that I had. And I had it over and over again. And I was like, so grateful to be like, you know, like it's really funny. Like I said to myself on more than one occasion that like the best part of like, say, a long all night, no sleep psychedelic experience at a festival, the best part often was like making scrambled eggs for everyone at 9 a.m. the next day, having, you know, on no sleep. Like that was that the ecstasy of that was like the incomparable beauty part. And feeding people and receiving the gratitude and all that. And like the thing that I was just referring to that I find funny when I reflect on it now is that I also frequently reflect on the morning after my first child was born. Both of my children were born at home. The first one was born at home on purpose. The second one was born at home by accident. So that one was a bit of a different experience. But the first one, you know, we had like midwives in our home, and like, you know, it was like so different from an experience of a childbirth experience from anyone else we knew. And it was like so much more wholesome and beautiful. And it was exactly what, you know, we wanted, of course. But then at like 7:30, she was born at like about 4:50 a.m. At like 7 or 7:30 in the morning, the sun's just coming up. I'm in my kitchen I'm making scrambled eggs for everybody, you know, for my wife, for the care team, for everybody. And I realized that it was like the exact same experience. It was more profound because of what had just happened. My being a father, making my first breakfast as a father was a pretty profound thing, but it was like just as like third eye opening of an experience, you know, like forget all the other things about it. I was like seeing like rainbows coming out of the ceiling just because of what had happened. And then I realized that they were not different things. Like the home leaving and householder practice are just, it's just scale, you know, it's just like what is the important scale of the thing that you're experiencing right now? And, you know, you can leave home and go up the mountain and achieve nirvana and come back in a 5-minute conversation with your little kid or walking the dog or making breakfast, you know?
That was really transportive and beautiful. Wow. Yeah, that was, I know what you mean about that coming home after a big experience and just the beauty of that. The ecstasy, the coziness, like the sense of integration. I feel like that's such a beautiful image or metaphor for householder spirituality. It's like bringing that in. And I think we touched on it a little bit, but just to clarify, like householder life, even though the term maybe sounds like literally like owning a house or like having a family, like how do you kind of conceive of it for people at various life stages, family structures, and so on?
Yes, always very grateful to be asked this question because I really want to go out of my way to assure everyone that I'm not just talking about married people with, you know, with children here. Like it does have that connotation, but a household can be many shapes and sizes, and most householders are the holders of many households. And I'm very explicit in my own work, you know, like the work that brings you and me together, that my work is for people at any stage of life who are aspiring to this path. You know, it's not like the home leaver path is like only for people who have already like sold all of their worldly possessions and gone up the mountain. You know, it's the same thing. Like if householder practice, this practice that we've been describing of the integration of the like holiest and most mundane things into one activity is your aspiration, then that is the householder path. It's a path, right? You're somewhere along it. And the key thing is that community is sort of a word. It's kind of surprising that that word hasn't come out of either of our mouths yet, I don't think. And
I was
that,
about to ask.
Yeah, it's not separable from this idea, because like a household is not an island. It's in a network. And that's what I mean by sort of holding many households. And it takes all kinds, but it's not just all kinds in terms of individual experience. It's like, it has to be intergenerational for it to count. It has to be, you know, it has to be diverse. And it, like, diversity is a very important thing to me. And some of that I think is maybe reaction against the homogeneity of the community that I was raised in. I didn't have like a sheltered, homogenous, Jews only kind of existence, but like I was surrounded. That's kind of what the problem was, is like I was in a pretty diverse school and a pretty diverse neighborhood and a pretty diverse city. And then I was in these Jewish spaces where it was like all one thing. And it was like, that was a very important framing for the reason we were in that space. And I felt very like constricted by that and have never sought that kind of space ever since. And that's not at all what our Jewish community here that my wife is a rabbi of is like. It's sort of, it's almost intentionally created for everyone else who felt like they didn't belong in that sort of monolithic, you know, assimilated Jews of European descent kind of situation. And diversity is really critical to this practice for that exact reason we were talking about at the beginning, about you and the lady on the plane, like the two eyes needing to see from slightly different perspectives in order to understand something better. And so to me, it is essential to the householder practice that you be surrounded by people from many walks of life with many different experiences, because that's the only way you can sort of assemble enough wisdom to get through not just the present, but like the future. You know, like we have a lot of unexpected things ahead of us as a species, as a planet. And, you know, it's going to take collective wisdom in order to rise to that.
I would love to hear about your wife's community that she's creating, also about the one that you have created.
I was joking at one point at the beginning of sort of my online community experiments that I sort of accidentally gave myself the same job as my wife. But my wife is a lot farther along. And so I sort of think of what she's doing as the main project in our life. And it's called Ma'alot, which means the heights. It sometimes refers to staircases, like ways of going up. But it can also refer to sort of like the top of the mountain, and which is kind of ironic because we've been talking about the top of a mountain as a home lever thing. But, you know, it's one of those Jewish terms. And Ma'alot is a spiritual community in Atlanta, Georgia, that has three pillars. Music is the one that she always lists first, which I really love. Nature and Jewish wisdom. And those three things combined create what makes a Ma'alot event a Ma'alot event. And we do holiday events. We do monthly Shabbat events. And we also do sort of different kinds of educational and experiential and musical experiences throughout the city. And it's sort of like a network more than a synagogue. Like, there's no physical location. We meet up in all kinds of places. We meet up in each other's houses. And there's several sort of venues that we use. And our members are members of all the synagogues. We are also members of all the synagogues in town. You know, it's not a competitive thing. It's like we're offering something that synagogues don't offer, which is, you know, services outside, services in the woods, services on camping trips that are 3 days long, you know, musical like journeys through the stories of the Jewish people that are, you know, not at all the kinds of things that you get if you go to synagogue on that holiday and hear the Torah read. And we try to sort of infuse it with our backgrounds in, fairly traditional conservative movement Judaism, because that's what some people need to feel comfortable stepping out of their comfort zone in the way that we're asking them to. And it's turned out to be this really beautiful, mixture and tension, generative tension between something that definitely feels Jewish to people, but also something that they've never seen before. And of course, like I said, it's also open to kind of anyone in town who has a connection to Jewish lineage from any direction. You know, really interesting some of the ways that people find us. And it's in its fourth year, and it's starting to really happen and solidify, and we're starting to have traditions of things that we've done many years in a row now. And it's really taken on, you know, and the music is a really important thing, like I said, and, you know, I'm involved in that part of it as well. And something that I'm noticing is that it's starting to take on a particular style. We're starting to have like a Southern Jewish sound that I didn't think, like, I don't know of like other examples. It's just like, we happen to have a banjo player in our sort of trio that we keep in the center of most things. And it's just developing its own feel. And it's starting to really feel like home to a lot of people. And so this is an in-person thing. There are some online components. And of course, like in the total lockdown period, a lot of it was all on Zoom. And then what we started doing was moving outside. And we had a lot of in-person gatherings in parks and stuff with, like, you know, social distancing and things like that, when people didn't really have any other kind of Jewish space to gather in because the synagogues all met inside. So, that was sort of where these connections first started to form. And now it's, you know, spreading out in all different directions. But as you mentioned, I also have my own sort of community experiment, and that is an online community, and it's an outgrowth of my website, which is where I write and post my own sort of takes on householder spirituality from these three lineage perspectives, including the astrology one. There's a lot of astrology on the site too. But I launched a membership at the end of last year that includes access to a message board that I built, which is called Base, which is a pun because base is how you say house in Yiddish. And it's also like, it's the prefix for like, you know, for the word for a synagogue or for a school or for something, you know, a house of worship, a house of study, you know, that's what base means. But I spelled it B-A-S-E, like as in base of operations, because it kind of has a nice pun. And it's a place for householders at any stage of life to get together and to talk about these things, these, you know, community issues and spirituality and family and livelihood. And you know, there's sort of sections for all of those things. And it's private, you know, I host it myself. You have to be a member to enter. And there are, you know, pretty well considered principles of confidentiality and respect that, you know, are sort of based on the things we've learned in Maalot with, you know, the kinds of guidelines you need to have like a safe and inclusive in-person space. And it's a little bit trickier online, you know, with like the sort of the ability for people to be pseudonymous or anonymous or not quite who they say they are or whatever. It turns out like with the trust signals up pretty high, it actually does succeed at feeling like a safe place. And so people on base talk about family and they talk about their job and they talk about the things they're struggling with, which they might not feel safe talking about on social media. And I certainly didn't. And that's part of what motivated me to do this was that, you know, I was finding all these wonderful people such as yourself on public social media and sort of having to shout over a lot of really unpleasant noise to make the connections that I wanted to make. And what I decided to do was just build an off-ramp and say, hey, if you guys want to talk about this, like come over here and check out this thing I made. And people have come and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, I love this. I feel like the kind of curated space is where it's at. And it is a type of gift to create a container or a space that has like a cultivated frequency. And I feel like there's some kind of wave here that you're speaking to that I feel like you're really on the cutting edge of, in the sense that people are getting tired of social media. I mean, that has been happening for a while, but I was very enthusiastic about social media for a really long time, even when people were tired of it, and I'm getting tired of it. So to me, that's like a metric. But part of it is just the sense of, oh, it's like noise, you know? And so there is a lot of value in these like curated, intentional spaces where you can have deeper conversations and know that the space is cultivated for quality, really.
So. Yeah, it's surprising me how game people are to put down something that you know, I certainly have personal experience with the compelling addictive nature of social media feedback, and like the amount of people who have agreed to at least try to go with something slower and with fewer inputs instead, and with longer posts, you know, more thinking and writing involved. And I mean, you don't have to, like, I'm always encouraging people to just like write one sentence and post it, like, you know, in this new environment where it feels all formal and structured, people feel like they need to write a whole, you know, manifesto every time they post. I'm trying to encourage people not to do that, but you know, at the same time, people are also willing to like really go there. And it's a huge relief. And this is a big part of why, of what I'm doing online now, but the other part is conversations like you and I are having right now. You know, I think that the willingness that some of us have to sort of jump out of the timeline discourse and have like protracted heart to heart conversations with each other like this and share those, I think is of immense value too, because it helps people see who these characters really are and the social media sort of constrictions on who a person is and what, and how much of, you know, how much surface area you have to grab onto. Like that can be so limiting. And so I'm really grateful to be able to really sit and talk with you also. And this is something we're trying to do on base as well. In fact, tomorrow, as we record, we're having our first face-to-face like discussion of a topic. We've done some FaceTime calls before, and we do meditation every day, every weekday. There's usually me, but some other people lead, like a silent sitting with cameras on, and people are finding that to be really supportive of their practice. But tomorrow we're gonna talk. We're gonna have like a really deep talk about a topic that we wouldn't want to talk about on social media. And so, you know, more face-to-face is really what I'm saying. It's just what humans deserve from each other as far as discourse.
Totally. Who are the people that have joined your site in general? Like, what backgrounds, what are they like?
I'm relieved to say that it's like 50-50 from my two internet scenes, really. Meaning, I didn't tell this story, but like my encounter with the astrology Twitter extended universe was sort of my second scene that I ended up in the, you know, pandemic era, social media, spirituality explosion. Because the first thing I came on to talk about was Zen practice. And so I had all these like meditation people that were my friends, and some of them are my longest running internet friends at this point. And then I kind of crossed the chasm into actually studying astrology with, you know, many of the people that you and I have in common. And then met you and all the like people who have been doing astrology online for a long time. So half of my householder members are from before that and are astrology curious and, you know, interested in sort of what these other people have going on. And then the other half are, you know, people at various stages of astrological study, ranging from new students to like pro astrologers that everybody loves and follows online. And it's
pro astrologers. I thought you were like bro astrologers.
Oh, no.
Like, what is this category?
I'm arguably the most bro astrologer. It's really, what's really been cool to see is that the parasocial nature of like people with tons of followers who do astrology online and like people with not a lot of followers who do astrology online, like completely dissolved. They're just being normal together as soon as they get onto base. And, you know, it's like, that's happening with everyone. All of that status crap just like disappears when you're in a place.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's interesting too, because social media is designed, I feel like, around status and numbers and like gaining a following and whatnot. And a lot of, you know, I'm grateful for a lot of things on social media. Like, I've worked with it a lot to grow my business, and it's connected me with amazing people. But there is an overall grid about like this kind of reward system around like getting likes and being popular and like all of this kind of stuff. And it's a game, you know? And like, I think that communities that aren't about that are about connection or about like learning something and whatnot, totally different cultural environment to be in. It makes sense that some of these status things dissolve in the space.
Yes, it does. And it's a huge relief, but also the learning and the teaching is still happening. Like, that's the really cool part, is like when somebody is an expert on something on base, they are asked to share and they are willing to share. And, you know, they don't like go crazy, like writing multi-chapter things, but like, you know, somebody who, like, let's Kira Ryberg, for example, who has written large handbooks on traditional astrology topics, is still willing to like chit chat with people in base threads about that topic, you know, just because it's fun to talk about, right? And then, but the coolest thing is that it's not like astrology knowledge is like the highest currency on base, because those people that are asking questions of like pro astrologers are also like the most experienced parents on this forum, or, you know how to like fix a lawnmower engine or something, you know, like there are other, like everybody is a genius at something there. And because the topics are so practical and urgent and every day, like it becomes very reciprocal, almost no matter who you are.
So cool. Has some of this kind of emerged, like this cultural experience of what you've created? Like, did you predict a lot of it or intend? Did something happen that you weren't expecting?
I'm really glad you asked this because it will give me the opportunity to get as real as I want to about it. Like it was hard for a few months for me because it was not, what was hard was I got people in the door at the beginning and that was a huge relief. Like, you know, obviously my worst fear was like, no one would want this and no one would join, but that isn't what happened. A bunch of people joined. But then they stopped coming back, or like there weren't enough people that there were always people online to sort of make it feel like
was going. I so feel that. Honestly, yeah. When people start things, I feel like I would like be like, this is just my Vesta time, you know, like I'm going to show up for the day in town where I'm giving readings and I'm in prayer the whole hours that I've said I was going to be there, regardless if one person came to visit me, and just like not. Like things take time to start and like you have to hold the faith and the prayer at the beginning. But yeah.
Yeah. And it was a couple months like that. You know, it started in December and there were a couple of months where I was like really worried that it wasn't going to happen. And, you know, what I was worried about specifically was that someone new would join and they would log in and there wouldn't be anything happening and they would go, oh, this is dead and I'll never come back again, you know? And I was having a really hard time privately. I don't know how much of it I let out in sort of my public. Actually, for a lot of the time, I was not posting in public kind of on purpose because I was having such a hard time and I knew I would just be complaining. But I leaned on some people for support. I asked them to come greet people when people came in the door. It was very hard for me to ask for those things. And I was just not sure that it was going to work out. And I'm still not, obviously, but I got us over the hump at some point. Like whatever sort of maneuvering I was doing to get more signups, just a few more. And then suddenly we reached a point, this is like 2 weeks ago, we reached a point where there is always somebody online. And one of the, there are all these ways that I sort of feel the heartbeat of the community to see if it's happening. And the most important one to me is that like there have been like several posts that day, like several different topics have come to the top on a single day. And we've now reached the point where it's really happening every day. And the best part is there are now enough people that it does like very few of these people are coming back every single day, but somebody is always there. And so there's like a different mix of people there every time. And that means when somebody comes back after 4 or 5 days of not being there, all kinds of new stuff has happened. And maybe some new people have arrived and things like that. So it's finally starting to kick in to feeling like there is always somebody coming through at some point. And I'm really trying to lay back, you know, like I'm just trying to be one of the participants in this thing. I'm not at the center of this. I don't like have my own content going into this forum, you know, like that's a separate thing. Everybody found this through my website, but like this isn't a place for me to post my stuff. So I try and encourage other people to have the conversations and, you know, if they pull me in for some inside joke that everybody happens to get because it refers to some long-running bit of mine, you know, so be it. I'm not ready to say like whether I know what's going to happen or whether I feel like it's succeeded or anything, but it's constantly surprising me now, and that seems really good.
Yeah, I love that you're describing it as alive in the sense that it has a pulse. And yeah, like when we create things, there is a facilitation, there's intent, but then there's also like what the thing wants to be and whatnot, which is, I imagine, also similar to parenting. Like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm curious what your daily practice is like.
It's very minimal these days. It was not so long ago that I was in my most intensive period of personal practice of my life. Since having post having children, that was when that period happened. You know, there were periods of intensive practice before that of like a few weeks on retreat or what have you, but like I'm talking about every day waking up at 4 a.m. you know, hour of sitting practice, qigong, light the altar, pull some tarot cards, you know, like speak to the planetary day ruler. You know, I was doing all of those things every day while I had a full-time job, which I recently left. I don't think I mentioned that part of the householder story, but that was like the most stressful period of my life. And I began to realize, this is like 3 years ago, we're talking about three years ago to 1 year ago, let's say. And I began to realize that there was something counterintuitive about daily practice for me, which was that I was actually, you know, I had a sort of common sense idea of it that like, it's something one does when one has a lot of space, and you know, the more space you have, the more practice you do. And that's sort of the goal, is to have a very spacious life with a lot of spiritual practice in it. But what I found was that the actual revealed behavior in my own way of being was that I rose to the occasion, that like when my life was demanding the most of me was when I was practicing the most. And it was because it was almost involuntary. Like I wasn't at easier times in my life when I was just sort of trying to get the habit of sitting Zazen every day, for example, I felt like I was pushing myself to wake up in the morning, to sit down on the cushion, to stay sitting down for the amount of time I had agreed to stay sitting down for. And this intensive period of a couple of years was not like that. It was like a necessity thing, or it was almost like an automated thing. It was like a thing that was doing itself to me. And it led me to a kind of crisis, like spiritually, that required me to make moves toward something that was more aligned with what I want, which is this, which is what we've been talking about this whole time. And that involved leaving the job and et cetera. And it wasn't pretty. There was, you know, I was very stressed out at home, and like my marriage was struggling. My relationship with my kids was very difficult for me. And, you know, I needed to cut something out. And what I ended up cutting out first was the 9-to-5, which was part of the sort of negotiation with my wife, Arielle, about when she was going to get to, you know, like getting paid from the thing that she was starting. And that, you know, we worked it out, we timed it, it happened. And then when I got my space and time and energy back and got my relationships back and started to, you know, ground back into my house, the practice really dropped away with me. And so I'm actually doing most of my like seated meditation practice as a base activity. I'm holding 4 of the 5 weekday meditation sessions for base people on Monday, Wednesday, Friday mornings and Tuesday afternoons. And that's all the sitting I'm doing, because it's like I'm doing something that feels like a lineage practice. It's like something that my teacher, you know, wants me to do. I'm holding meditation space for people, and that's part of the practice. I do keep my altar cooking. I was telling you before we started recording that I like just burned a bunch of incense before we sat down. The candles are still going over there. I kind of do that while I work now, you know, like I have a devotional, I consider my work to be pretty devotional at this point, whether I'm writing about spirituality on my own or whether I'm actually doing this work. So I light the incense, I light the candles, I sit down at my computer and I do this stuff. And then I, you know, put it out and go for a 2-hour walk and think about it all. You know, that's really what a lot of my practice does.
You know, it's interesting, like having those times in life where we have that much time for contacting spirit. I am trying to think of the parallel for me, because it definitely wouldn't be so structured in terms of a practice, but a lot of prayer, like a lot of like spirit led, you know, ways of being. And that part of my prayers inside of that are for things that I actually want to materialize in my life. And then when my life materializes, it's like, well, this is the practice now, you know, or even like the manifesting a relationship thing. I don't really do that anymore. I don't try to manifest. I mean, I do in a different way, but before it would be like such a ritual, you know, like this like magical prayer practice. And then the relationship would appear, and it's like, well, now this is the story that we're playing out. And so, yeah, finding that way to integrate that level of devotion into a busier day that's full of things that you prayed for you know, and also like to be able to navigate the challenges that come up in the busyness. And like you expressed, like making changes in your life so that you could live in an aligned way, I feel like is part of this kind of spirituality also.
That navigation is a lot of the energy work part, you know, and like, that's something that I have no real formal training in, except that I have a lot of training in the sort of household or relationship navigation part. And so, you know, I have a lot of very challenging heart open conversations and, you know, try to repair a lot of relationships, you know, like things you sort of, just living a life as a human being, like, just causes a lot of pain. And, you know, a lot of my practice is involved in sort of healing that damage as quickly as I can and trying to make things right with people. And that's all very householder stuff, but it's also, you know, it's as subtle of a spiritual practice as I've ever done before.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. How is base a job for you? Like, yeah, how would you describe kind of your work in that way, and how this work supports your household?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And at the beginning, I didn't have another idea for how I would sort of generate material financial support for my family other than sort of making this website happen. And I have since then, so I should probably mention that too. I've taken the pressure off of myself to make base something that is so financially sustaining that it's my full-time job. And base isn't the only thing that generates money for me on my website. I also do astrology for clients. And so far, actually, that's still been more of the revenue, if we're going to go all the way there and talk about it like that. But I don't feel that much pressure to grow it anymore beyond the point of base being sustainable as a community. It's already, my website is sustainable now. The amount of work that I put into every aspect of my website, including just the publishing stuff for free on my blog and whatnot, like, that's all taken care of itself because of the ways that I've given people ways to support my work or to hire me for various kinds of spiritual work, which I also consider, people joining Householders, which is the name of the membership. Base is not the only thing that comes with that. And so there's a few other things. People who join Householders, I make it pretty clear that what you're doing is like supporting all of my stuff. And so people, you know, who like that work are supporting me to do it with my time. But the amount of time that I'm putting in is feeling very good. And I do want to grow, but I only want it to grow so that base feels like more of a home to more people and is like really active and generative. And, you know, I make websites for a living. That's what I've always done for a living. I didn't expect this one to make any kind of living. And it's, so far, it's making part of a living. But now, two friends of mine from the spiritual weirdo internet and I are starting a company making websites for people. And that will provide, hopefully, the rest. And this is the way that I will support my family with this work. And, you know, it's going to definitely be enough on my plate. And, you know, but another really important part of the answer is the skills that I'm developing and sort of handling the delicate nature of spiritual community is really helping me support and advise my wife and other people directly in our community. There are pieces of the Malo community that I hold personally too. I'm sort of the founder of the men's work container, which is something she asked me to do, but she put me and three other guys in a circle and said, you guys figure out how to do this together. And so I sort of am the one rolling the ball forward on that men's work. And it's similar to the things that I'm doing on base, except that, you know, gender wise, it's very different actually. But that I don't know if I would be as ready with like contemporary, like relevant ways of doing this work in in-person community if I didn't have this whole sprawling online community thing going too. And I think she agrees. I think that she has leaned on me more for ideas since I've started doing this, because this has shown me and her some pretty interesting things about like having real spiritual community in this day and age.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just like being in the experiment and figuring out what works. And there's often, yeah, I feel like when I'm figuring things out with my business or communities, that there's discoveries I come upon that seem so human and so essential, but I hadn't necessarily thought of it before. And it just settles in like this new layer of like understanding or heart opening and whatnot. And there's some repair inherently in that, just in terms of the mainstream or like overarching culture having a lot of alienation, a lot of disconnection in a lot of different ways. So finding our way back to creating connection and building bridges is a really beautiful discovery. Well, can you tell the listeners, like, first of all, if there's anything that you feel like wants to be shared, and then how people can find you?
No, I feel super complete. This has been very beautiful. Thank you for the chance to talk about these things. Thank you for sharing your points of view on it all with me. That's that. My website is at taalumot.space, which is spelled taalumot.space, as in outer space. And you'll find everything there. Householders is there. You'll find that there are also various astrological readings, which, you know, is a whole conversation we didn't even have, but that's totally great. And those are all written.
Yeah, no, if you want to share a little bit about your relationship with astrology, because I know you do like horary and different kind of divination things. So yeah, please share that with us.
Yeah, it's true. I do. I offer written astrological readings that are, and horary is sort of my bread and butter. I'm trained by Adam Ellenboss and John Frawley style horary astrology. I also studied electional astrology with Kira Ryberg, and I offer elections too. And I sort of consider those to be related pursuits.
There's probably people that don't know what those things are. If you want to.
Yeah. So I was going to kind of talk about them together. Horary is the kind of divinatory astrology that I do, which uses the chart of the moment. That's what horary means. It means of the hour. You use the chart, the astrologer's chart, for their location at the time that they receive the question, to find the answer to the question. So you go.
It's
to
a trip, honestly, like how effective it is. And yeah.
And I write up my charts when I get them right or wrong. And I keep track of my batting average on the website. It's about 80% accurate these days, actually it has been the whole time, which is really crazy to me. Like those weren't the kind of results I was expecting. And there's plenty of examples of kinds of questions you can ask on the site, but you know, I can answer questions like, will they go out with me? Or am I going to get the job? But also it's great for finding lost objects. Like where is my passport? You know, is a classic. Where's my cat? You know, I find it unreasonably effective for cat questions. Cats are just like very amenable to astrology. They may not be amenable to anything else that human beings do, but astrology really works on them.
I don't know if you can hear my cat. She's been meowing a lot.
mine are probably bothering someone else in the house right now. So horary is really fun, and it's like low impact. You don't need to send me your birth chart or anything like that. You know, you just send me the question and I respond with the chart and the judgment, and I write it down. As I said, I do offer one face-to-face consultation, which is a new thing. It's called the fireside chat, but that isn't necessarily an astrology reading at all. That's sort of whatever you want to come to me about. And we can do astrology if you want, but you know, we don't have to. But these astrology readings are all these like written reports that I do. So horary is one. Elections are basically using the same principles as horary astrology, but it's to choose a moment that's sort of like the realization of your goal. You know, if you want to start a business or ask someone out or release some creative work of yours and you need an auspicious date for it, elections are how you use astrology to find the ideal moment to do that. And those are rooted in your nativity. So it's like what moment coming up is like the best expression of this dream of yours, of your natal promise. And that's my favorite kind of astrology to do, because it's very technical, but also involves really like sort of imagining the sky in the future. And, you know, I like to include a screenshot from an astronomy app in an election write-up when I send it to someone, so I can show them what like the sky will look like where they are when they do the thing. And it's, you know, people find that very inspiring to, you know, especially if they're like nervous about some venture that they're about to head off on. You know, elections can really provide a lot of support and confidence and blessing for that. I do have one natal reading, which is called a weather report, which is basically using transits, but I use other timing techniques too. That's just a, you know, rather than like a full on, like, who am I and what is my purpose in life kind of natal reading, it's just sort of like, tell me what's going on in my current circumstances and what's around the corner type of thing. And yeah, those are all, you'll find all of those on there too. And householders get half off on all of those readings. That's one of the benefits of membership. But of course, the main thing is base. And you know, that's how you go to my website and you join householders, and then you get access to base, and everybody's waiting for you. And I hope people will sign up.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us about householder spirituality. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Sabrina. It was a real pleasure and honor.